This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine a major court victory exposing the Trump administration's targeting non-citizens for ideologically based deportations.
Ramya Krishna from the Knight First Amendment Institute unpacks the case and what it means for our fundamental freedoms.
Then we take a look at how AI algorithms shape the news we see each day.
Andy Lee Roth from Project Censored introduces a new tool for journalists to hold tech accountable and to uncover biases in AI. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. On September 30, 2025, a federal judge in Boston issued one of the most important decisions that's been rendered during the 9 months of Donald Trump's second term. Following a 9-day trial in July that included the testimony of 15 witnesses and the admission of scores of documents, U.S. District Judge William G. Young of the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts ruled that the Trump administration's policy of arresting, detaining, and deporting non-citizen students and faculty members for their pro-Palestinian advocacy violates the First Amendment. Judge Young was nominated by President Ronald Reagan and has served on the court for over 40 years. While there have been over 200 other court rulings involving Trump since January, this was the first decision following a full-dress trial. The case, known as AAUP versus Rubio, was brought by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, partnering with the law firm of Cher Tremont. The attorneys represented the American Association of University Professors, including AAUP chapters at Harvard, Rutgers, and NYU, and the Middle East Studies Association, MESA. The association's members included tens of thousands of faculty and students across the country. In his historic ruling, Judge Young wrote, quote, "This case, perhaps the most important ever to fall within the jurisdiction of this district court, squarely presents the issue whether non-citizens lawfully present here in the United States actually have the same free speech rights as the rest of us. The court answered this constitutional question unequivocally, yes, they do. No law means no law. The First Amendment does not draw President Trump's invidious distinction, and it is not to be found in our history or jurisprudence." We're very pleased to be joined today by Ramya Krishnan, senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute. Ramya served as lead counsel at the trial in AAUP versus Rubio, and she presented the opening and closing arguments in the case. She holds a BA and LLB from the University of Sydney, where she served as editor of the Sydney Law Review, and an LLM from Columbia Law School, where she was Raymond J. Baer Scholar. Ramya, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, congratulations, Ramya, on this very important legal victory. Here at Law and Disorder, we've been watching this case very carefully. Please begin by telling us why the Knight First Amendment Institute and your co-counsel and the plaintiffs brought this case in the first place. What actions by the Trump administration did you believe violated the Constitution?
So this case is our challenge to the Trump administration's policy of targeting non-citizen students and faculty for deportation based on their pro-Palestinian advocacy. And since Trump took office, we've seen a number of non-citizens targeted under this policy of ideological deportation, Mohsen Mahdawi, a Columbia University undergraduate, was arrested when he appeared for his naturalization interview. You have Rumeysa Öztürk, a grad student at Tufts University, who was seized by masked ICE agents from a public street in Somerville, Massachusetts, just because she wrote an op-ed calling on her university to divest from Israel. And then, of course, you have Mahmoud Khalil, who helped lead student protests at Columbia, who was arrested in the lobby of his apartment building in New York, spirited away to a detention center in Louisiana, and locked up there for more than 3 months. And these are just a handful of examples. Unfortunately, we've seen many other students and faculty targeted as well. And these actions have cast a powerful chill on college campuses across the United States, causing many students and faculty to self-censor. Many of the AUP and MESA's members have, for example, withdrawn from political advocacy. They have declined to publish scholarly and popular writing. They've foregone research opportunities that would have required international travel. Some have even self-censored in the classroom. So we brought this case ultimately because we believe that no student or faculty member should have to live in fear that they will be locked up and deported simply for engaging in lawful political expression.
Judge Young issued an extraordinary 181-page, detailed and comprehensive written decision. We'd like to ask you several questions about this decision. First, please give us the highlights of the judge's factual findings. What did the judge find you had proven at the trial regarding Trump's policy of ideological deportations? And also, what witnesses and documents did the judge cite to support those factual findings?
His key finding was that the secretaries of state and Homeland Security intentionally and in concert engaged in a campaign of intimidation, a campaign that involved arresting, detaining, and deporting individuals like Mr. Khalil in order to chill pro-Palestinian speech and speech critical of Israel. He found that these officials and their agencies embarked on this campaign, this policy, following President Trump's issuance of two executive orders early on in his administration, which target, among other things, anti-Semitism, quote-unquote hateful ideology, and support for terrorism. Significantly, Judge Young found that this policy was an intentionally viewpoint discriminatory implementation of these executive orders. He found that at every stage of the policy's implementation, Secretaries Noem and Rubio and their subordinates interpreted support for terrorism and anti-Semitism, activities they construed to be possible grounds for visa revocation and deportation, to encompass and indeed center on lawful pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel speech and association. Now, Judge Young found that the intent here wasn't to round up every non-citizen pro-Palestinian protester. Rather, he said, it was more invidious. It was to target a few for speaking out and then use the full rigor of America's immigration laws in ways, quote, that had never been used before, to have those individuals publicly deported with the goal of suppressing pro-Palestinian student protests and terrorizing other similarly situated non-citizens into silence. And he had a rich record to draw from to reach these findings. First, he had public officials' public statements, and there are so many of these public statements that they have made since President Trump's issuance of the executive orders. In a fact sheet that was released in connection with those orders, Trump in fact threatened, quote, to all the resident aliens who joined the pro-jihadist protests, we put you on notice. Come 2025, we will find you and we will deport you. So the intent here was unmistakable. Judge Young also had testimony from government officials. There's testimony from senior DHS officials describing the operation they launched to identify pro-Palestinian protesters on college campuses, an operation that, by their own admission, involved scouring lists of suspected protesters from the likes of shadowy organizations like Canary Mission and producing reports that repeated those organizations' unvetted allegations that protesters were anti-Semitic and pro-Hamas. We also had testimony from a senior State Department official, an official named John Armstrong, who personally made the decision to revoke Ms. Ozturk's visa and who authored the memos recommending that Rubio revoke the green cards of individuals like Mr. Khalil on the grounds that they posed a foreign policy risk. In a striking admission, Armstrong confirmed that under his understanding of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, criticism of Israel, including its actions in Gaza, is grounds for deporting non-citizens from this country. In fact, he said that criticism of the Trump administration's policies or actions towards Israel may qualify. And there was a rich documentary trail that Judge Young's decision summarizes at great length that backed this testimony up.
Now let's turn to Judge Young's legal conclusions, in which he linked the evidence you've just described to well-established legal principles and Supreme Court precedent. What do you consider his most important legal conclusions?
Well, I think the most important conclusion he reached is the one you mentioned in your introduction, which is that the First Amendment protects non-citizens inside the country just as it protects U.S. citizens. Now, throughout this lawsuit, the government has argued that non-citizens present in the United States don't have the full protection of the First Amendment and may, consistent with Supreme Court precedent, be deported based on nothing more than their lawful political expression. And they pointed to cases from the McCarthy era, cases like Harrisiadi's, which greenlighted the deportation of non-citizen members of the Communist Party. But what Judge Young correctly recognized is that non-citizens do, in fact, have the same First Amendment rights as citizens do, which means they can't have their visas revoked. They can't be arrested, detained, or deported based on their lawful political speech and association. He rightly found that this conclusion was compelled by the doctrine, citing, of course, the Supreme Court's seminal decision in a 1945 case, Bridges versus Wixon, where the court declared that the freedoms of speech and the press are accorded to non-citizens who are residing in this country. And he properly distinguished cases like those cited by the government, cases including the one I mentioned, Harrisiadi's, on the basis that when those decisions were rendered, you know, affiliation and association with the Communist Party was not protected even for U.S. citizens. So as bad as that decision was, it does not mean that the U.S. government has the power to deport non-citizens who are lawfully present in this country based on what is now well recognized under First Amendment doctrine to be protected political expression. And he also found that this conclusion was compelled by First Amendment values, recognizing that the First Amendment's chief concern is not the identity of a speaker, but instead the character and quality of speech in what Justice Holmes has called the free trade of ideas, which has long been understood to be the best test of truth and the best means of ensuring that the government doesn't tilt public debate in its preferred direction. I think that, Judge Young's decision is entirely consistent with well-established First Amendment principles, But it's still significant that he reaffirmed this fundamental proposition, which is foundational to free speech and democracy in this country at a time when it is under unprecedented attack by this administration.
The judge indicated that in the coming weeks he would address the question of remedies. What judicial relief are the plaintiffs in this case seeking?
Well, at bottom, what we're seeking to do is to end the administration's policy and practice of targeting non-citizen students and faculty for deportation based on their political viewpoints. And so we plan to seek a number of measures, a ruling, of course, a declaration that what the administration has been doing is unlawful, that it violates the First Amendment and, in addition, the Administrative Procedure Act. We plan to seek relief under the Administrative Procedure Act, relief that would entail setting aside this policy that the administration has been determined to implement and enforce over the last several months. We would seek injunctive relief, which is to say an order from the court prohibiting officials from continuing to enact this policy, and a range of oversight measures that would allow us to monitor the government's continued compliance with the court's remedies in this case.
The decision will surely be appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals and eventually to the Supreme Court. What do you consider the greatest strengths in the record you were able to create at the trial? And what is it about Judge Young's decision that gives you the best chance of prevailing on appeal?
Well, I think the record makes it emphatically clear. What the government has been doing here is targeting non-citizens based on their lawful political expression. And as I mentioned earlier, Judge Young relied on a wealth of evidence to support his findings in this regard. The litany of public statements made by public officials, which made no secret of their intent here, which was to chill pro-Palestinian expression. He also relied, as I noted, on the testimony of government officials, documents that were before the court. And as Judge Young found, this is not a case where officials were hiding the ball. They were shouting it from the rafters. They were boasting about what they were doing. They were taking political credit for it. And it was only in Judge Young's courtroom that they denied what they were doing. And I think his findings of fact do a really careful job of giving the lie to that denial. In terms of his conclusions of law, I think, he engages closely with Supreme Court precedent. He explains how his conclusion that non-citizens inside the U.S. have First Amendment rights is not only consistent with, but compelled by well-established case law. But I think an interesting aspect of his decision, and something that I think goes that step further to insulating his decision on appeal, is that he recognizes and holds that it doesn't matter what standard of First Amendment scrutiny you apply in this case, because even under the standard advocated by the government, that is, that they only have to show what's called a facially legitimate and bona fide reason, the government's policy fails, because acting on the viewpoint expressed by a non-citizen in their lawful exercise of First Amendment rights, that's not a facially legitimate reason. The government may revoke non-citizens' visas and deport them for many reasons, but the one reason that the First Amendment prohibits them from acting on is a person's political viewpoint.
Your colleague, Jamil Jaffer, has said this historic ruling, quote, should have immediate implications for the Trump administration's policies. Do you think Judge Young's thoughtful and well-reasoned decision could have an impact on other pending litigation that challenges other Trump policies?
I do. I think it might even have an immediate impact on the cases that these individual students who've been targeted, individuals like Mr. Halil and Ms. Ozturk, are litigating in the courts. Because the government has claimed in those cases, and indeed in our case, that they weren't acting on lawful political expression, that they had secret evidence that was too dangerous to air in public, that showed that they were engaged in unprotected conduct amounting to support for terrorism. And what our case forced them to do is to put all of that evidence before the court. And the court concluded resoundingly, they were targeted based solely on their protected political speech and association. And I think that that finding the evidence relied on by Judge Young in this case gives those individuals further ammunition in their cases. But I think Judge Young's decision has more far-reaching implications than that. One of the most striking and important features of his decision, he doesn't just take at face value the government's asserted interests in combating anti-Semitism and protecting U.S. citizens from terrorism. He acknowledges that those are, of course, legitimate interests, but he doesn't allow the government to use them as a fig leaf for what was, in fact, happening in this case, which was a deliberate campaign to target non-citizens for deportation with the singular goal of silencing protected political expression in this country and casting a chill on academic communities across the United States. And I think that that commitment to look through the government's purported justifications, to really test them based on the evidence before it, is important. And I hope something that we see in some of these other cases challenging Trump policies. The court heard testimony from Peter Hatch, who was the head of the Homeland Security Investigations Office of Intelligence, which is ordinarily tasked with preparing reports that summarize intelligence on people who are suspected of having committed violations of law. He testified that he had been directed, that his unit had been directed to review the profiles of everybody listed on the Canary Mission's website, over 5,000 individuals listed on that website, with the purpose of identifying pro-Palestinian protesters whose visas and green cards could potentially be revoked by the State Department. That website is notorious for including profiles of people who have engaged not just in advocacy that they deem to be anti-Semitic, but speech that is broadly critical of the Israeli government and its policies, speech that is supportive of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And Peter Hatch testified that his unit prepared hundreds of reports on student and faculty protesters that included wholesale, unvetted allegations from the Canary Mission's website that these individuals were anti-Semitic and pro-Hamas. And these reports essentially made their way through HSI through another unit called the National Security Division, ultimately ending up at the State Department. And as I mentioned, the senior State Department official who testified at trial, John Armstrong, admitted to the court that they don't have any official definition of anti-Semitism or support for terrorism that they use. His employees who have been instructed with applying President Trump's executive orders, they haven't received any guidance on what these terms mean. But he said that engaging in this activity, speech that they deem to be anti-Semitic or supportive of terrorism, is grounds for revoking a non-citizen's visa or deporting them. And he had an extremely capacious understanding of what constitutes anti-Semitism and support for terrorism. He frankly admitted that criticism of Israel, including its actions in Gaza, is, in his view, potentially anti-Semitic and pro-terrorist. And he said that criticism of the Trump administration's policies or actions towards Israel could fall within the bounds of those terms too. And so what Judge Young heard from the relevant officials in this case is that applying these extraordinarily broad definitions of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, these agencies were intentionally targeting protesters for deportation based on speech that was simply lawful pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel expression, and that they were doing so with the intent of chilling student protests on college campuses across America.
Where do you see this case of AAUP versus Rubio taking its place among key court battles that have advanced the cause of freedom of speech in American history?
Well, I think Judge Young's First Amendment holding is an important milestone in the doctrine. It's a really robust defense of non-citizens' First Amendment rights at a time when those rights, as I mentioned earlier, are under unprecedented attack. But there's another part of the opinion I don't want to overlook, which is that he ends his opinion with this quote from former President Reagan, which recognizes that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction and that it must be fought for and defended constantly by each generation. He expresses fear that President Trump understands the meaning of that quote, but has drawn from it a cynical conclusion that the American people are so divided that they won't stand up for and fight for their constitutional rights so long as their personal interests aren't affected. And his opinion concludes with the question, is he correct? And I read that question as a powerful call to arms, a recognition that if we are to protect our most fundamental freedoms, if we are to protect our democracy, then we all of us need to step up to show courage and meet this moment, and that it will not do to sit on the sidelines. And on that, I think he's exactly right. So I think that his opinion is significant in more ways than one. It's significant for the careful way in which he documents the administration's intentional campaign of intimidation. And if that's all his decision did, it would be damning enough. But his First Amendment holding is significant. And I think his call to arms is highly significant too, particularly in this moment.
Ramya, again, congratulations on your important victory. And thanks for joining us again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Artificial intelligence is transforming the newsroom, from how stories are written and headlines are chosen to which readers see which articles. Algorithms, those invisible sets of instructions that guide everything, from Google searches to social media feeds, are now shaping journalism itself. They can amplify or silence voices and determine which stories gain traction in the public sphere. For journalists, understanding how these AI systems work isn't merely a technical issue, it's essential to a democratic society. Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists is a new online resource to help reporters and editors navigate this complex new terrain. The project equips journalists to hold technology platforms accountable, explain AI's influence to the public, and confront the hidden biases and power structures influencing our algorithmic systems. Joining us today is Andy Lee Roth. He's the editor-at-large of the watchdog group Project Censored and its publishing imprint, The Censored Press. Andy co-edits the State of the Free Press yearbook series and co-authored The Media and Me, a guide to critical media literacy for young people. A sociologist, since joining Project Censored in 2006, Andy has led media literacy initiatives, including developing the Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists projects, that web resource helping reporters understand how AI shapes and distorts news and society. He joins us now live from the MediaFest 25 conference in D.C. Andy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Heidi. It's a pleasure to join you and Stephen.
Now, you're at MediaFest 25 in Washington, D.C. Tell us briefly what that is and why you're there.
Well, Washington, D.C. is pretty quiet now, but the hotel where MediaFest is being held may be one of the more lively places in the city. Some 1,400 is the count I heard. Journalists and student journalists have gathered here, brought together by the Society of Professional Journalists, the Associated Collegiate Press, and the College Media Association, three organizations that together put on what they bill as the nation's largest media convention for pros and college students. So it's been yesterday was Workshop Wednesday, and today the full program is in swing, and it's quite dynamic. And I got to say, at a time when journalism and journalists are under attack, it's invigorating to be in the room with lots of working journalists and to remind each other of the importance of this work, of journalism as one of the pillars, a pillar that's being chipped away at, but a pillar of democracy.
Well, Andy, we are grateful you took time out of the conference to be with us, and good for you to work with young journalists as well. Let's begin with the basics. What exactly do you mean by algorithmic literacy, and why is it so vital for journalists today?
Well, I work with Project Censored, as you know, Stephen, and we've been champions of media literacy, especially critical media literacy, since before there was a term of that sort. And algorithmic literacy is, in some sense, one of the multiple literacies that constitute media literacy broadly. And so if we break it down, we can talk about literacy as the ability, obviously, to make sense of and to use whatever type of literacy we're talking about, right? So if it's reading literacy, where that term originates from, it's the ability to read and to create texts of your own by writing. When we're talking about algorithmic literacy, it's the idea that you can be able to make sense of when is an algorithm, or when more generally is artificial intelligence at work, how is it affecting the media content, say, that I see, and also a crucial part of any kind of critical media literacy is the ability to do things with these tools yourself, to create using the literacy skills that you have. So algorithmic literacy isn't a term that's super common right now, but part of the project that I've been working on is to try to bring it to greater attention, especially among working journalists and people in the news industry.
Well, Andy, let's talk now about your fellowship with the Reynolds Journalism Institute. How did that lead to the creation of Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists?
Thank you, Heidi. I got to say, I'm pretty proud to have been, I guess I still technically am, one of the Reynolds Journalism Institute's 2024-2025 institutional fellows. We applied for a fellowship about a year and a half ago, proposing a project on algorithmic literacy for journalists as a niche that would, a need that wasn't being met by existing programs. And we were fortunate enough to be one of, I believe, seven fellowships RJI funded out of about 200 applications. So, and RJI then provided tremendous support through a kind of an amazing nine-month period working with other fellows and working with people at RJI to provide the support and the resources necessary to build the interactive website that was the kind of final product of the Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists project. So if there are any journalists or aspiring journalists out there with innovative projects, I'd encourage them to look into the RJI fellowship program. It's an incredible program, and its purpose is to help incubate projects like this one that serve the public interest by promoting, you know, journalism of the highest standard.
I gather there are two main tool sets within the Algorithmic Literacy for Journalism project. How do journalists use them in their daily reporting?
So one of the things I learned from working with Kat Duncan at the Reynolds Journalism Institute during this fellowship is that, of course, journalists are super busy and under incredible deadline pressure, so that everything that Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists provided, if it was going to be used or adapted, had to be in easy to adapt bite-sized chunks. And so that's how we got the organization for the website that we have. There are two units, as you say, Stephen. One is focused on algorithmic accountability, and this includes subunits on relevant questions to ask, both of sources and the reporter asking themselves about their own reporting. Newsworthy sources to seek out, expanding the scope of authorized sources so that it's not limited to industry spokespeople and tech developers who are frequently the only sources on stories about AI tech development, and then using informative frames to avoid common pitfalls in AI reporting. So each of those is a subunit of algorithmic accountability reporting. The other major substantial unit is on algorithmic gatekeeping, which is actually what the workshop I gave at MediaFest yesterday was focused on. And this includes things like responding to shadow bans on social media, sidestepping advertising block lists, and conducting what we call do-it-yourself algorithm audits to produce newsworthy stories that promote algorithmic accountability. So those are that's the kind of macro organization of the website. And again, the aim, not easy to achieve, is to have everything as technical as it is developed in a way that people can come and grab something and take it and use it without doing a ton of homework. The idea was that the research that we put into the website was the homework, so that things are almost like when you're at the airport and there's the grab and go deli tray, right? You can pick something up and use it in a story that you're going to work on today for deadline tomorrow.
Andy, let's go into a little more detail on that. You've said that algorithms are, quote, revolutionizing how news is gathered, produced, and consumed. Can you paint a picture, give us an example of how that would play out in a real newsroom, for example?
So on the production side, one of the challenges, I think, is that, of course, AI is already baked into the very tools that reporters are using on a daily basis to cover news. So one of the most basic kind of AI literacy points that I know is that search is not neutral. When we punch in search queries into a search engine, the results that we get are not, in some ultimate sense, objective. They are the result of an algorithm at work looking at a variety of things, including if you're using a web browser that is your regular web browser, your own search history is going to shape what comes up when you search for, say, news on Palestine. So search, which is a tool that all of us use every day, is also a fundamental tool for journalists. And if search isn't neutral, if search comes with built-in kind of pathways that it runs to more readily and pathways that it almost never will illuminate or guide you to, that is a problem in terms of the free flow of information. On the consumption side, a lot of people are getting their news through social media and maybe one step removed using a news aggregator, an online news aggregator, to find highlight stories. Avram Anderson, a librarian at Cal State University Northridge, who I'm proud to have as a colleague, and I, a few years ago, we looked at the Google News Aggregator. We were interested in what kind of stories it was highlighting as LGBTQ stories, headlines. And we looked at a week's worth of Google News and found that something like 46% of the stories that Google News was reporting came from conservative, or what I would consider arch-conservative sources. A number of those sources you wouldn't even probably consider to be journalism outlets. And they were filled with content that was, frankly, homophobic and transphobic. We wanted to see if this was commonplace, so we looked at another news aggregator, the DuckDuckGo news aggregator, and we found a very different picture. There we found a much more balanced political spectrum of views and much, much greater representation of news organizations, stories from news organizations that you and I would look at and immediately say, oh, yes, that's a familiar news organization, not, oh, that's a fringe group that I've never heard of before. Anyone using Google News at the time we conducted this study to look for news about LGBTQ issues would have gotten a very different picture of what the going concerns were that week than if they had used another news aggregator. And so that's invisible unless you do that kind of comparative research. And most ordinary everyday news consumers aren't going to conduct that kind of research. So part of what algorithmic literacy for journalists is trying to promote is, in effect, what Avram and I did is what we came to call a DIY algorithmic audit of Google News. That's something that doesn't require, we call it a DIY audit because it doesn't require special tools or technical abilities. It's one way we have of chipping away at the idea that these AI-driven tools are, quote, black boxes. There is truth to that in the sense that the companies that develop and use them consider the workings of the algorithms that drive them to be proprietary, meaning there's not access to them. But they aren't black boxes in the sense that they are literally inscrutable devices or programs. They're black boxes because people are making choices. Developers and the controllers of these devices are making choices to keep them from being accessible not only to the general public, but even to independent third parties for review. The bigger solution is ultimately that there needs to be, and this is part of what the ALFJ project is about, there needs to be tech industry accountability for these algorithms and how they work. And at the very least, if not public access to the algorithms, at least access for independent third-party reviewers to see if there are biases and prejudices built into the algorithms that shape so much of the content that we see on a daily basis.
Andy, earlier you mentioned journalists being worried about shadow banning. Tell us what shadow banning is, and along with being demonetized, how do those algorithmic gatekeeping practices affect press freedom?
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Stephen. So when we talk about shadow bans and also advertising block lists, we're talking about restrictions on social media that can render newsworthy reporting, especially newsworthy reporting on controversial topics, less visible or invisible. And shadow banning is a kind of a blanket term for a variety of content reduction practices. And so they're shadow bans because they're not takedowns, right? Content is still up, and the person who posted the content, they won't know that access, the reach of that content has been reduced, but it has been reduced. The concern for journalism is that many journalistic outlets and many reporters are using social media, so platforms like Instagram, for instance, to inform potential audiences about reporting, right, about legitimate newsworthy content. And if shadow bans are restricting that reach, that's a problem for newsrooms. It's also a problem for the public because this kind of reduced visibility can shape what not just one individual person is likely to see, but what society is likely to attend to, take seriously, struggle with, value, as Tarleton Gillespie has highlighted. The shadow bans seem to have disproportionately affected Black publishers and LGBTQ content publishers. And they, in general, make it more difficult to hold platforms accountable when those platforms restrict already marginalized voices. Part of the strength of news is that it gives a platform to a diversity of perspectives. Shadow bans are especially pernicious. The other thing I think I would add just quickly now in terms of shadow bans is when a content creator, say a freelance journalist who's promoting their work on a platform like Instagram, when they reach out to Instagram and say, hey, you know, my latest posts don't seem to have the reach that they normally do, can you explain? The response is often a form of what one researcher has called black box gaslighting. And the idea of black box gaslighting is like, well, we aren't going to let you know, except in very rare circumstances and very narrow definitions of what constitutes shadow banning. None of the major tech platforms acknowledge that shadow banning even exists, much less that they practice it themselves. And so what content creators are told when they see these 90% drop-offs for, say, controversial news content that is nonetheless legitimate news content, they're told, oh, there just isn't an audience for that kind of content. You know, you should try something different. So that's a form of gaslighting that is specific, I think, to this sort of technological niche.
Andy, I'm loving all these new terms, shadow banning or black box gaslighting. Just to ask a basic question, what are some of the biggest misconceptions among the public about how algorithms actually work?
One, we've already touched on a little bit, the idea that search is a neutral conduit of information, that search engines provide us kind of an accurate reflection of whatever it is we've queried the search engine about. And we know from numerous studies that that's simply not true. So this fundamental tool that many of us, including myself, use every day to gather information, whether for work or for our personal lives, this is a filtered conduit. And I think that's an important thing to know. I think there's also a lot of misinformation, and this is something journalists and journalism can do better on. Two sides of a coin, a misconceived coin. One side of the coin is AI is going to save the world, right? And there are critical scholars who talk about this group of people as the boomers, not as a generational term, but the idea that AI, like the golden days are ahead of us, and AI is going to save journalism, and it's going to solve the climate crisis, and so forth and so on. And there's a lot of hype out there to support that kind of understanding of AI as waiting in the wings to fix all our most egregious, deep-rooted social problems. The flip side to the boomers are the doomers, right? And they're the ones who believe that AI is going to, you know, lead to the robots are going to take over the world in a Terminator 2 kind of scenario. AI will be the end of humanity and maybe the world as we know it. But there is the other side of it that, like, the public needs to know when there are AI systems that can address social problems, The promise of AI deserves good journalistic coverage too. And here, I think I want to give a shout out to the Solutions Journalism Network, which if people don't know about it, it's a great resource. You can go to the Solutions Journalism Story Tracker and find a whole, in effect, channel of solutions-focused reporting from big corporate outlets and small independent outlets, all of which are highlighting positive solutions-oriented stories about tech and AI. So there is good reporting about this out there, but a lot of what most people are seeing from kind of the big establishment journalists, journalism outlets, I think falls, you know, most of the time falls into one of these two extreme camps, and that doesn't serve the public interest.
Let's talk about big tech. In your view, what responsibilities do large AI and tech companies have toward transparency in their algorithmic processes?
There's a lot of unfulfilled potential there, I would say. I don't consider myself an expert on AI generally. My focus has really been on AI and its intersections with journalism, but that still leaves a lot of room to for improvement in terms of the question you asked, Heidi. One of the things that I come back to all the time is a major difference between any of these big tech companies that you want to talk about, so Meta, Google, platforms like X. They have zero commitment to the principles of ethical journalism. That's, I suppose, at some level to be expected. They were all founded as for-profit entities, and that is their bottom line. And although, for instance, people like Elon Musk like to talk about X as a kind of so-called digital public sphere, there are a lot of questions to be asked about that. To try to answer the question in a succinct way, journalists seek the truth and report it. They attempt to do so in ways that minimize harm. They do this in part by acting independently and by being accountable and transparent. I think we could look at those ethical standards as outlined by the Society of Professional Journalists and ask, what would AI look like if it started from ground zero with those commitments? Or if you want to turn it into a question, we can ask, is AI, as it's currently being deployed and developed, is it accountable and transparent? Does it allow us to act independently? Are there guardrails in place to minimize harm? And is it ultimately committed to seeking and making available the truth? And I could give answers to each of those questions, but they wouldn't be ones that would be flattering for big tech companies, I don't think. I know we're short on time. A little less than 2 years ago, a number of journalism organizations issued what's known as the Paris Charter on AI and Journalism. And this outlines 10 principles that ought to guide the development of AI as it pertains to journalism. And I won't go into all of those now, except to note two things. One is that journalists, media outlets, and journalism support groups should engage in the governance of AI. They should have a seat at the table. I don't know of any big tech platform that's asking journalists, hey, how about coming to our meetings and helping us figure this out? That's going to happen when journalists and journalism outlets begin pushing, right? We're back to a kind of a Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without demands, never has, never will. The other thing is that when the Paris Charter on AI and Journalism was issued, and this is by Reporters Without Borders, the chair is a Nobel Peace Prize awardee, journalist from the Philippines, I was able to find 3 U.S. news outlets that covered the announcement of the Paris Charter on AI and Journalism, editor and publisher, The Voice of America, and Nieman Labs. It was invisible otherwise. So there's a lot of room here, I think. It would be great if the AI companies did it themselves, but I think the way it's going to happen is when others push, right? Power concedes nothing without a demand.
Andy, you've written for outlets like The Progressive and In These Times. How has your sociological work and background informed your work on media accountability?
Thanks, Steve. That's a wonderful question. My training as a sociologist makes me especially alert to power, issues of power and power inequality and the consequences they have for different groups of people. And so that's a fundamental frame for my understanding of algorithmic literacy for journalists. I was influenced very early on in my research developing this project by a researcher at Stanford, Pratyusha Rhea Kalluri, who published a great article in Nature magazine in 2020 called "Don't Ask If Artificial Intelligence Is Good or Fair, Ask How It Shifts Power." And I think that's the fundamental question that all of us need to be asking, whether we're in journalism or in the general public. How is AI shifting power in our society, between different groups of people? And the focus of algorithmic literacy for journalists, if we think about the profession of journalism, how is AI shifting power between journalism and other big institutions in society, such as the tech industry? The answers to those questions are not easy or simple, but asking those questions is how we're going to keep our orientation. And then the other thing to me, I come back again and again, and I suppose this is related to a sociological commitment to inquiring about power dynamics, the SPJ's code of ethics and the idea that we're pursuing truth, we're trying to do it in a way that minimizes harm, and the avenues for that include being accountable and transparent and acting independently. And those principles, I think, can guide not only journalists who are covering AI tech development, they can also serve as a kind of compass, an orienting compass for members of the public who are trying to navigate all the complex questions that AI raises on a daily basis if we're paying attention.
It would behoove us to look at the impact of tech lobbying on how we create legislation or don't, that would put up some guardrails to protect citizens from using AI in a way that's harmful to us. But this has been a riveting conversation, and we thank you so much for taking time out of the conference to be with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi. Thank you, Stephen. It's a real pleasure to join you on Law and Disorder.
How can our listeners follow your work, Andy?
Well, they can find almost everything that we've been talking about today online at alfj.org. So ALFJ, just the acronym of Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists. That's a free and accessible website. And then most of my work is available through the Project Censored website, projectcensored.org.
Thank you so much again, Andy. Enjoy the rest of the conference. And you've enlightened us in so many ways today.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Stephen.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.